Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guests today are geologists Michael Machette and Jeff Tepper. Michael is a practicing earthquake geologist. He's got extensive experience dealing with various kinds of geologic risks at lots of major facilities where you want to know those sorts of things, like power plants and dams and pipelines. For most of his career, he was a research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. I met Michael here around town through his role as a board member of the Jefferson Land Trust. Additionally, I know that he is, in fact, quite the ringleader for the Quimper Geological Society, and that's an affiliate of Jefferson Land Trust. And then Jeff is an emeritus professor in the geology department at the University of Puget Sound, and his research uses geochemistry to investigate geologic questions. That seems like a gigantic field. And most recently, he has focused on the tectonic history of the Pacific Northwest, the environmental history of Puget Sound as recorded in lake sediments, and the behavior of heavy metals in sediment. Jeff describes himself as a hard rock geologist, geochemist, and geomythologist. So before we go any further into our conversation on sort of hard rock geology in our neck of the woods, I have to ask, Jeff, what is geomythology?
So geomythology was a freshman seminar that I developed at Puget Sound, where we read myths like the sinking of Atlantis or the parting of the Red Sea. And then we ask, might that myth actually have originated as a geologic event, which has come down to us in a distorted form? But if we read through the myth, can we pick out elements of it that are recognizable as actual geologic events? We generally don't know the answer. We can't prove it in most cases, but it's a good way for students to think critically.
Fascinating. Actually, that could be an entire different program, stretching actually beyond probably the myth of the Northwest, but interesting. So welcome both Michael and Jeff. And before we talk about hard rocks, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So my hint for you today is a bit odd, because you've probably actually never heard this sound. But as I was looking for a mystery sound for this week's program, I discovered this one on the internet, and it was just so cool and so interesting that I had to share it. But I do encourage you to try to guess what it is. So now, let's talk about rocks in eastern Jefferson County. Earlier this summer, I saw an announcement of an outing sponsored by the Quimper Geological Society. It was for a hike. And the hike was to go from H.J. Carroll County Park, that's down near Timicum, to the Timonamus Rock Sanctuary, and then on up to Timonamus Ridge to see Tarragon Rock. Well, the hike was advertised as rather strenuous, steep, and rough, and I knew with my bad knees, I wasn't going to be able to participate. I read that the hike was to be led by four rock stars from the Geological Society. So I knew that one of those rock stars just had to be Michael Machette. So I contacted him to see if he could bring the height and some of the geological information to us on the radio. I want to talk about glaciation in just a minute, but I want to also, just for listeners too, that Michael and Jeff, for this exploratory walk the Geological Society put together a guidebook that they've been refining. And in it, there's a cross-section. It's sort of a geological profile of Tumanos Rock and its surroundings. And, of course, in profile, you see it as this just humongous rock. But what's kind of odd is that it sort of sits out away from, I mean, it is spire. It sits out away from other massive deposits. And Michael pointed out to me that in cross-section, if you look at Tumanos Rock, it looks like the dorsal fin of an orca, which is kind of, it really does. So, Michael and Jeff, Tumanos Rock. I've seen it from Finn River. If I look sort of northwest-ish, kind of over towards Anderson Lake. But what does it look like?
Hi, thanks, Nan. Yeah, you can see Tumanos Rock from Chimicum Valley in several places. Along Highway 19, around the Circle and Square, there's a view of it. You can see it from Finn River, as you said, around the Four Corners area of Chimicum, and from some of the higher vantage points in the valley. But it's starting to become hidden by the ever-growing surrounding forests, so I'm sure the view 100 years ago was much more prominent.
When it was prominent, I can imagine that it was a very singular and significant site in the valley. What did the first peoples of the area, how did they regard the rock? Was there a significance to it? Was there myths around what it might be?
Yeah, let me maybe back up a little. I forgot to mention it's kind of a rocky spire-shaped knob that sits on the north end of the valley there in Chimicum. But the rock's literally been there exposed for all the time the first peoples had been in the area, that being after the deglaciation in the late Pleistocene. It was a sacred prayer site. It was an overlook, and it was a place to gather and hunt. So, but by the 1980s, it came to be owned in a commercial sense by Westerners that were taking over the area. And in the 1990s, it had become a favorite climbing location, which was frowned upon by the first peoples. However, the threat of commercial development led the Tsklallam tribe to buy the property in 2008. And at that point, it was established as the Tumanos Rock Sanctuary with the help of the Jefferson Land Trust, as you mentioned. Now it's permanently protected and on the Washington Register of Historic Places since 2015.
Wow, that's cool. So let's go back in time and think about Tumanos Rock and its formation. How long ago was that?
We've dated it a couple of times and using radioactive decay as a tool. And so the two ages we have, one is 46 million and the other is 43 million. So it's in the mid 40 million year old range.
So I'm now looking at my cheat sheet because I have never been able to really remember all the various geological ages. So that would put it after the dinosaur extinctions and during the period where mammals were beginning to expand, right?
So this is about 20 million years after the dinosaurs disappeared.
Okay, got it. At that point, what would this region have looked like?
It was very different than today. So the Olympics were not there, the Olympic Mountains were not there, the Cascades were not there. And it was a much warmer, tropical kind of climate. So we know this from several lines of evidence. One is that at that time, coal was forming in Western Washington. So coal is associated with swampy, warm conditions. So Black Diamond, coal mines in Centralia, coal mines in Roslyn, all of those coal deposits date from about this time. So they tell us it was a low relief sort of coastal plain with rivers coming from the east, probably coming in from Idaho, coming across present day Washington, but not encountering the Cascades. And then draining into the Pacific in a sort of flat, swampy plain.
So I'm trying to visualize that, and I'm thinking, in a way, it might look like the sort of the plains of North and South Carolina. You know, you sort of take the Blue Ridge Mountains out of the scene for a minute and just look at that flat.
Yeah, or the Gulf Coast.
Or the Gulf Coast, right. Wow, quite a bit different. So how did it form?
Tumanos Rock?
Yeah.
So it's the remnant of a volcano.
Really?
And it was an explosive type of volcano. And there's several ways we can tell this. So if you walk up to Demonomous Rock, you can take the trail all the way, put your hand right on the rock.
So that's allowed, and even though it's protected.
Right. So you can't collect samples or mark it or anything, but you're at the trail there, and you are permitted to go up and see the rock up close and personal. So there's several things that you can see that would tell a geologist something about this particular volcano. One is that it's what we call a fragmental rock. It's a big cliff face when you get in there, but within that cliff face, there are fragments of rock anywhere from dust size all the way up to several feet across. And these angular blocks are floating or embedded in a matrix of the same material that's just been crushed more finely. So volcanic rocks come in two flavors. They can be flows, which solidify from a molten liquid, or they can be fragmental, which are the product of a more explosive type of eruption. And Tamanos Rock is the latter. It's the product of an explosive eruption, which fragmented the existing volcano, blew it apart, basically, and then those fragments came to rest as a product of an ash flow. So a violent, explosive rock and gas.
What would have been a similar kind of volcanic eruption that might be familiar to some of us?
There have been eruptions of the dome at Mount St. Helens.
Oh, that right.
Explosion.
Yeah.
And then there have been, the type of volcano is called a dome. And domes are relatively small volcanoes, not as big as Mount Rainier, just a few thousand feet high perhaps. And those are characteristically steep-sided and erupt explosively. So there are some in Japan.
Hmm. So would there have been other volcanoes around at that time?
There probably were. So we've found ash from multiple places along the east side of the Olympics. When you have ash, you don't really know where it came from because it could have traveled in the wind or on water. So we don't know where the vent was. Demonomous Rock is the biggest accumulation of lavas. So we know there was a volcano near there, but there were probably other ones.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. If I would anthropomorphize the rock for a moment, I'd say it's formed, we talked about it's like 20 million years after the dinosaur extinction. So it would have, quote unquote, seen a lot in its history. Give me a couple of examples of things it might have seen.
So you gave us this question in advance, and I thought about it. It's a really interesting question. So at the time it was erupting, the Cascades had not yet begun to erupt. So one of the first things that would have taken place after Tamanos Rock erupted was the beginnings of more volcanic activity to the east. And it wasn't yet a big mountain range like it is today, but there were scattered volcanoes off to the east. And then that was a time of, as I said, it was very warm at the time when Demonomous Rock was forming, but it was a gradual cooling, so there would have been a vegetation change, a disappearance of the swamp environment and a drier climate. And that probably was increased in part because somewhere around 18 million years ago, the Olympics began to rise. So at the time Demonomous Rock was forming, the Olympics were not a mountain range, but beginning somewhere around 18 million years ago, they started to rise. And that would have produced then a rain shadow on the east side, so it would have gotten drier for that reason. And then the Cascades began to rise somewhere around 5 million years ago. So at that point, Demonomous Rock was nestled in between mountain ranges on both sides.
So my cheat sheet also tells me that was about the time that the Andes Mountains were forming, which kind of makes some sense, I guess.
Well, they're all related to the same process. And then most recently, so beginning maybe 2.5 million years ago, we started to have an ice age. And so we would have begun to see glacial advances coming down between the Cascades and the Olympics. And that would have, it's part of what removed the evidence that there was once a volcano there, because the ice has ridden over that place and carried away much of the earlier.
Well, in more recent geological history, we know, of course, that this area was glaciated. what would have happened during that period with Tamanmas Rock sticking up there?
Tamanmas Rock probably didn't really become a spire until recently. And that's because as glaciers advanced through the area, they would have deeply carved the Chimacum Valley with time. And when that happened, you probably removed the buttress or the bookend that held the rock into position against And if you remove the bookend, the rock has a chance to move laterally into the valley. And that's what I think is happening, that the spire, the shape of that dorsal fin, it's tipped over as if the spire wants to come down into the valley. And so with further glaciations, that could be accelerated or it could do it on its own. But right now, that big spire, 150 feet high, is leaning out over the valley. When you stand below it, where Jeff took the field trip, you look up and you look back to see the top, and it's really a spectacular view. But behind it, there's a rock wall at the edge of the valley, which could be controlled by tectonics or just a fracture. And there's a separation in there of 50 or 60 feet. Does that sound right, Jeff?
Something like that, yeah.
So it's like a crevice or a...
A big crevice.
Big crevice.
You can walk up the backside. It's not encouraged. You can walk up the backside of Tamanmas Rock to top out on, and that's probably where the first peoples went to have ceremonies, because you had a view of the whole area from the top of Tamanmas Rock. A spectacular view.
And you're giving hints about just how powerful glaciers are. So you're suggesting, and let me see if I've got this right, that the glacier has probably removed its buttressing rocks or its foundation, and then the spire tilted. That's what you're saying?
It could have been any time from then to 100 years ago. Who knows? Part of the story in here is that when you look at the landscape with aerial photographs, you see trees. You can barely see the rock. But when you look at the new technique called LIDAR, you can, which is what I call the virtual chainsaw, it removes all the vegetation from the landscape, and you see the real shape of the land. And when you look at the LIDAR image in that area, it's a massive landslide topography. Hummocky terrain. Tamanmas Rock is one of the biggest rocks, but there are other smaller sub-Tamanmas Rocks to the north of there. So the story involves both the removal of the buttressing and landsliding down into the valley.
So are those landslides active? Are they likely to continue?
Well, as long as they've got relief and it's moist, they can be moving. They're never really stable until they become graded down to a really low level. But let me say a few things about LIDAR and how it's done, because it's a modern technique that's just changing the whole interpretation of landscapes. Imagine an airplane flying over this ridge back and forth in a series of flights. It has a laser beam in it that scans 30,000 points per second back and forth in a swath. They collect terabytes of data. So the computer uses an algorithm to look at the travel times of the rays. The ones that travel really far hit the ground. The ones that travel less far hit the top of trees. They say, give me all the longest response times. Just map that. Now you're mapping the ground. If you were doing a forest inventory, you could map the top of the trees, remove the ground, and you could get the thickness of the tree.
So you're filtering for
distance. Well, when you go for the bare ground filter, then you see all the detail that you can't even see on the ground. It's spectacular.
Interesting.
They should look at our paper, because we've got a really good LIDAR image there.
All right. Well, you know, this is endlessly fascinating to me, and I'm a zoologist. I mean, what can I say? But we are soon to run out of time. And
Michael and Jeff were so kind, because they did agree to come back for a part two of the Hard Rocks of East Jefferson County. So the first week of November, they'll be talking about glacial erratics in East Jefferson County, particularly Tarragon Rock. So join us the first week of November to hear more about geology in our area. So now is the time to reveal the mystery sound. So first, let's hear that sound again. Well, as you might guess, I was looking for a rock sound to use this week. And roaming around the internet, I found the recording you just heard. It was from a PBS Nature program. And the program was called Kilauea, Mountain of Fire. Kilauea is, of course, an active volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii. And the PBS program featured the work of Milton Garces, a researcher who uses and records infrasound in order to better understand what's happening in Kilauea's underground lava tubes. Now, infrasound, and I had to look this up too, is sort of analogous to the notion of infrared, where there are sound waves, instead of light waves, there are sound waves that are at frequencies below that which is hearable by the human ear. And then the infrasound sound waves are then adjusted via computers to be audible in that clip you just heard. So volcano infrasound research actually began with the eruption of Krakatoa in 1883. That was in the area that we now call Indonesia. And then numerous volcanoes all over the world have been found to produce a significant amount of infrasound. So the physical explanation seems to be that as the magma rises to the surface in a volcano, pressurized gas comes out of the magma, and the release of this gas causes pressure fluctuations or infrasound. So anywhere there's pressurized gas being released, it's a possible source of infrasounds. And these sounds can even excite large underground cavities into resonance. It's sort of like blowing over a beverage bottle or ringing a bell that can resonate other things. And Kilauea also has its own unique voice. And the infrasound work at Kilauea has captured a wide variety of signals: tremors, explosions, sound from lava skylights, fissure eruptions, collapses of benches. Kind of think maybe the romantics among us can say that Pele sings these amazing songs. Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We do hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petridge. And if you enjoy learning about the natural world around us and sharing your curiosity with others, please consider joining the Nature Now team here at KPTZ. Just drop a note to naturenow@kptz.org to explore joining our team. There's no special requirements required or skills needed, just curiosity and friendliness. It's actually great fun. Podcasts are available on the KPTZ website. It's kptz.org. And I want to just recommend to you over and over again, the podcasts are a great place to listen to current and past programs on your own time schedule. I use them a lot. In our ending music, I actually want to play a little more of the music of Kilauea.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.